Hey, everybody. Welcome to the official first episode of Getting Stuff Done in Higher Ed. I'm one of your three hosts, Fritz Vandover, and I'm joined by two friends and colleagues, Kevin Schreiner and Kelvin Bentley. Say hello, gentlemen.
Hey, everyone. Hey,
everybody. How's it going?
So, one thing we want to do as we introduce this podcast to the world is we want to talk about why we're doing this, because there are lots of podcasts about higher ed. So why are these three guys putting out another one? So we'd start our podcast with that. And then the next three episodes, we're each going to have a time to let you get to know each of us in turn. So first, why are we doing this? So why are we doing this, guys? What have we talked about?
I think there's so many reasons to be doing this. I think one, the three of us have so much in common, and so many different connections within this higher education space. And I think so much to share on so many different levels and different connections with different folks. And so I think we have a great opportunity to really kind of bring some of the behind the scenes and some of the front of the scene things that we've done and continue to do, and share that with other folks who maybe learn about higher ed for the first time or just interested in other aspects.
Or early career too, I think.
Early career. I think that's a great one.
Yeah. I mean, between the three of us, I think we have pushing, I don't know, 80 plus years of experience just in higher ed and related, you know, educational technologies, et cetera, that are bolted directly to higher ed. So we are not new to this world. I'm the last to turn 50 this year of the three of us. That'll be in November. Yippee for me. So yeah, that's a great reason, is that we've been around a bit. There's actually one of the names we were kicking around before we settled on this one is, you know, something about mocking our age but taking advantage of it. Kelvin, what about you? What drew you to launching a podcast together about this?
Oh, I think kind of all of the above. I would also say I've always wanted to do, to have a podcast, you know, with colleagues. I've been an invited guest, but there was something about also hosting it. But I also knew, just given my schedule and other commitments, it would be hard to kind of do it all on my own. And so it's great to do it with other people, but also people that you know and you trust. And I also think, just given our perspectives in this space, I think we can highlight maybe some things that are not always like top of mind in terms of what's going on in higher ed. My hope too, you just mentioned something too, which was important, about like maybe giving back to early career folks. I think we've all had some interesting adventures. I've also, maybe for good and for ill, I've had a lot of different positions in the 25 plus years I've been in higher ed. Not always because I chose. Sometimes choices were made for me, because I have been laid off before or been caught up in reorganizations, just crazy things that I don't always share on LinkedIn, let's say. And so amongst us friends, and maybe amongst us, our listeners, I can speak to some of those things, and maybe, you know, it could be a reminder to folks that, hey, you know, sometimes you have to kind of keep your head on the swivel. And to do that, will be maybe different for you than what it was for me, but but my hope is that, you know, maybe we can give some advice to kind of help people always be nimble and be thinking about like, what is next for me? Right. Like I think about my dad, for example, who worked for Chrysler for, you know, yesterday was his birthday, and he just turned 82. And I was like, yeah, you know, I remember my dad working for Chrysler for like 40 plus years. And in our space, at least in terms of what we do, which is not full-time teaching, As an administrator, that's very, very rare. And so how can you stay relevant, especially given the fact that the world of work is changing so quickly because of various priorities, and your competition is not just other people, but also things like AI, and it's a crazy time. So I think this is the right time, I think, to do this type of a podcast where we can share insights and then also think about what is going on in the world in terms of, again, just various things. So
is it fair to say, guys, that I'm the one who broached this idea?
It's a fair statement.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll give you kudos. Thank you for including both of us. Yeah. I sincerely appreciate it.
Well, so right. Kelvin.
Otherwise, we were going to do like the Kevin and Kelvin, That's right. That was our backup plan.
We've known each other for a long time, Kelvin. I actually knew your wife before I knew you, but it's been like 13 right. years now since we started really connecting and getting to know each other. Kevin, it's more recent, but we've known each other like 4 or 5 years, but I've been tracking what you're doing for a long time too, not only in your day gigs, but your adjacent work in the data and higher ed. But from my perspective, I wanted to do a podcast about higher ed, first of all. And the reason I wanted to do it with guys like you that I know is, I mean, my career has been centered in this, and this is my discipline of study. You know, my PhD is in higher ed policy and administration. So I tell people I'm a higher ed nerd. I met some young guy yesterday at the car dealer. He's studying to be an aeronautical engineer. And, I was asking about, he goes to Embry-Riddle. And so I was asking about it. And I was like, look, I'm just a higher ed nerd. I'm looking up stuff about Embry-Riddle. So I wanted something that moves around the different kinds of, wanted to have conversations about the different spaces that affect higher ed. It's not just this. We're not going to just talk about marketing. We're not just going to talk about ed tech. There's a lot of places, a lot of spaces, podcasts, and publications that talk about that stuff, blogs endlessly. But it's not that we wouldn't talk about it, but I wanted a space, frankly, because for a long time, I feel like a lot of the chatter, the discourse about higher ed is conducted, curated, I don't know the right word for it, but by folks who haven't always worked a lot in higher ed. They've been adjacent to it somehow. Ed tech is a big space they've been in, or they've come in from, they've had a cup of coffee, for a little while at institution, then they've gone out in the tech space or the consultancy space. They all have great, really important perspectives. But to me, being in an institution and having a lot of time in it, in different kinds of parts of it, whether it's teaching, administration, marketing, is every advising, you name it, the IT and academic technology side, there's no substitute for that. Because you get to know the ins and outs of an institution. And then if you move between institutions, now you start to get a really deep comparative skill set, knowledge base. And you cannot read your way into that, meaning through blogs or whatever. You have to live it. So as we've talked about how we're going to do this podcast, one of the things we want to do is we want to talk to people. And this is why it's called Getting Stuff Done. And as you all should know, we were going to call it Getting Shit Done. But then we figured no one respectable would want to talk to us. Yeah. So Getting Stuff Done is we want to talk to people who are getting stuff done in whatever capacity they're in, whether it's faculty, whether it's staff, whether it's administrative leadership. We were talking earlier before we hit record, the associate director of admissions at a regional institution, people who aren't highlighted necessarily in the Chronicle or, they're not at GSV, ASU, but they're critical to the functioning of higher ed. Like, I would love to talk to some institutional research people right now because they are really in a weird space right now, weirder than it's ever been, I think, at least in our career arcs time frame. So these are some of the reasons we wanted to put together something like this, a podcast, basically an insider's podcast about higher ed and all the kinds of aspects. Mm-hmm. So we're going to sometimes talk to people, bring them in, talk to people who we think are interesting and play important roles in getting stuff done in higher ed. And sometimes it's just going to be the three of us talking about a subject that's maybe just emerged and it's hot on the scene, whether it's technology or AI or policy or macroeconomic, whatever, or just something that's longstanding challenge or feature or some aspect of higher ed. So that's a really, for me, that's what drew me to doing something like this. Plus I like to talk to my friends. So this will be fun.
I think it's going to be really fun. I think we have a huge opportunity, to your point, to really start to shed the light on things that most people don't realize, things that are outside of the news, or even just going deeper on things that are inside the news.
Or misportrayed in the news.
Or portrayed in the news. Or, yeah, I mean we could spend a lot of time talking about just a lot of the stuff that is out there about what higher ed is doing and how higher ed operates and all these types of things. And one thing that I've always said, and I think this podcast is really going to gear us towards that, is higher ed does a really poor job telling their own story. And I see this as an opportunity for at least three people who've been in this space to help others tell their story or to tell our story of things that are going on. And because we've all been in such a different, we've all played different roles, right? I mean, I think that's the thing that those of you that are listening, you're going to start to see, is that we're not doing this as three, you know, agreeable individuals that we all believe exactly the same thing. I mean, we're three independent people on this podcast. And that's kind of also what I look forward to, is the opportunity that we may disagree on certain things, or we may have different perspectives on different mm-hmm. things, but that's the world we live in, right? Like that is the world of higher ed. And so it's, we're not doing this because the three of us think exactly the same way. And we have this perspective that we're going to try to transform and impose on to people that are listening. It's really to share what we think. I'd love if we could do a call-in, right? Like have an episode where it's just like figure out how people can dial in and like ask questions. Cause I think there's going to be some topics that are just going to be like,
Well, I think we'll definitely have a way for people to submit things they're interested in.
Yeah.
Would you all talk about this? Would you talk about that? Which would be honestly a good way to find some guests to have on.
And I think we should put that out there right now, Fritz. Like, so if you are interested in being a guest, let us know. I mean,
we'll have our ways to get in touch with us, email addresses, whatever, socials. We're still getting started here, people. Give us a little grace. So, I think we should actually, I think we have plenty of time today because we've only been recording for like 15 minutes. I think we should talk about, get into why higher ed's been horrible about telling its story. And I, Kelvin, I'm going to kick it over to you to kick that kind of discussion off.
I think it's for a lot of different reasons. I think almost like psychologically in some ways. And we were actually, before we started today's podcast, Kevin and I were having kind of a separate conversation about something, but it made me think about how the culture of higher ed is the culture of higher ed, right? And Kevin, you know, you just mentioned something before too, like even if you work at this, let's say at the same institution, you may not always be on the same team, right? Or the same frame of mind in terms of where the institution is or where it needs to go. And I think that puts you in a boat where everyone is either rowing in different directions or saying, you know, I'm not going to row at all. And so, you know, you end up kind of just like, you know, not really going in any one direction. And I think that's higher ed's problem. I think there are certain people, certain leaders from the top, right, who want to do X, Y, and Z, but then they're messaging down to everyone else who actually gets stuff done is heard or maybe not heard in the right ways. And so then you're in this weird telephone game like, you know, where the message gets diluted as it moves through the layers of the institution. And it just makes it really tough then to then, for, let's say, an institution and, of course, for higher ed in general, to tell the right story. I think another problem, too, around the culture is that higher ed, I think, has gotten really comfy, cozy with the way things have been, right?
Yes.
And because of that comfort, that makes it really tough, even for the innovators to really, like, you know, to move the institution. So maybe I'll just pause there and get your reactions to all of that.
I want to jump in and I want to piggyback on that because I look at it through a very historical lens. So you find out in my episode, but, you know, my bachelor's and my master's are in American history. And so while I didn't focus on the history of higher ed in any of those spaces, or even my doctorate, I do read a lot about it. I think about it a lot, the history of higher ed. You're talking about comfy, cozy. I mean, to me, the reason higher ed's become bad about telling its story and its value to the U.S., to the world, et cetera, is because for so long, after World War II, first of all, there was endless demand. You don't have to really justify your value when demand is out the roof. Why do you need to justify your value? Because, first of all, everyone wants to come to you and they have the means either because it's really affordable to pay for it, or they're getting student loans that make that affordable cost easily bearable. Granted, it's not now. And then the other thing was the value of it to those learners, to those recipients of those credentials, was big and growing. So, you know, I like to say where I work now at the university that, you know, the university is adapting to this new space where they don't just have to put out their shingle, their sandwich board, say, hey, we're the University of Minnesota, come here. And everyone comes here. And we have plenty of students and we got all the students we need, or, you know, enrollments are growing. That world doesn't exist anymore. So part of the reason it's not great at telling its story is because it really never had to tell much of a story before. So now it's having to tell its story. And that's, if you've never had to tell the story before, it's really hard. Like, what do I do and why am I valuable to this community that we're situated in? You know, like, we're in the Twin Cities, so we're community, state, region, US, global, et cetera.
So that's interesting. Fritz and I have similar background as well. Master's degree in history, minor in history, undergrad. But I also have taught history of higher education.
I'm jealous.
At the graduate level, which is a course that I love. But it's everything. Like, there's segments, right? There's segments to this growth in higher ed. So to your point, we saw all this growth after World War II, all the GI Bill, everybody coming back to school, getting that degree that they weren't able to get because they decided to go off and fight the war when they were 18, 19 years old. And then, but in the 60s, we saw that transition to the community colleges, where we really started to think about this whole separation between what does a four-year institution look like and what does, I'll just say, workforce development type programs, and what do they look like? I think the development of the community colleges, and then if you look trend-wise, like, we're all talking about, you know, this impending cliff and that there's fewer and fewer students that are coming to school, which I don't disagree with. I do have concerns with some of the metrics that are used to kind of get to that, but I don't disagree that we have fewer students. But we also had fewer students in the 80s and the early 90s. And so, like, there's like this, like, it's just this ebb and flow that continues to go through higher ed. And I think where I think I struggle with when I say higher ed doesn't do a good job telling their story, I think they allow sometimes what's being said out in the universe to direct their strategy. And so, oh, we have this cliff coming. And so when we don't make our enrollment goals, we all just say, well, it's because of the cliff, or, you know, it's because of this, or because, you know, we saw this out there, versus owning, like, who you are and where you are in this space. And who do you want to serve? Who do you want to be? You know, I had the luxury of working in Florida at a community college when we transitioned to a four-year institution.
Oh, wow.
Right, when we started offering baccalaureate degrees.
Is this in the 90s or 2000s?
So this would have been early 2000. It was 2009, 2010 when we started making the transition. St. Petersburg in Florida had already made that transition. But the rest of them, the whole, so there's an organization now, the Community College, I think it's Community College Baccalaureate Association. I'll have to check that name, but I think it's something like that, where there's this pattern out to help more and more schools become four-year institutions, community colleges. And all of our degree programs are aligned towards workforce, right? So education programs, business, nursing, some of those types of things. But you also had to have approval from your closer four-year institution as to whether or not there was going to be an impending degree program. But it's transitions like that. And now the transition's a three-year degree.
So here's a question for you, Kevin, though. Was the value of that apparent, that transition to a four-year institution, or at least offering baccalaureate degrees, bachelor's degrees, and is it still apparent? Does the community, you said, it, where is it in Florida? St. Petersburg?
Well, St. Petersburg, all of the community colleges now in Florida are state, they are now state colleges.
So they all offer suite of
baccalaureate. They all offer at least some form of a baccalaureate degree.
Well, I'm not going to, well, no offense to Florida, but the value of higher ed is clearly not apparent in Florida these days. So then I retract my question. I was going to say, did people see it and realize, oh yeah, this is a good thing, and you know, there was a receptiveness to that in the, at least among students, the target market of students.
I think there was a receptiveness within the education community. I don't know. Part of it was,
did they tell their story well, is what I'm saying.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that community colleges that have transitioned to four-year institutions have told their story really well up to this point. So are we actually graduating more? Like, the whole goal was, how do you graduate more individuals with a baccalaureate degree, right? So that was one of the pushes for creating baccalaureate opportunities at community colleges. For some people, for some individuals, and we think about our what we used to call our non-traditional student, right? Our typical adult learner, over the age of 24, have children, have a job, have all those things that are keeping them from going somewhere else. And so Florida structured themselves really well with where community colleges were placed with where four-year institutions were, right? So there was always a pathway. Mm-hmm. If you're at a community college, you could go to a four-year institution. But now with online, it's different somewhat. But for people to be able to pack up and leave and go, so when we started doing this, Florida Gulf Coast University was fairly new. University of South Florida was really our institution in our neck of the woods. You had to go still from Fort Myers to one of those places if you wanted to continue your degree. And so it was really seen as a pathway to grow more people in the state of Florida with a baccalaureate degree. And so what are the right degrees? And so to not compete with universities,
right. They
had to be BAS degrees, Bachelor of Applied Science. They had to be workforce ready, workforce development type degrees, so that we weren't offering history degrees. We weren't offering psychology, the liberal arts and things like that. But
so it's fairly niche that those other bigger institutions often didn't fill.
Right. Or didn't have the capacity. Like, if you think about a nursing program, there's so limited capacity to go to a four-year institution because they're only going to take so many students. And so if you're not going to offer a baccalaureate degree at the community college where they just got their RN, then how are you serving the hospitals that want to have more individuals with a BSN degree? So it was trying to create gaps. And I think it was also, it was also during this time where higher ed peaked in enrollments in 2010, right? So we had this peak, and then all of a sudden we've had this decline since that recession. And so I think it made sense. I don't think there's been really good storytelling of baccalaureate degrees and whether or not baccalaureate degrees at the community college really give you what you think you're getting? Like, did we get more baccalaureate students, or would they have never transferred? Like, that question I don't think has been answered.
Was it just a shell game, is what you're saying? That students who may or may not have done something, they're just moving to a different institutional setting versus new students coming into that, reaching more students. Yeah.
Correct. Right. Or did we get more students because we offered a pathway to a baccalaureate degree?
Right.
Or did we just get people because they want to? I think for some programs, I think we did. I think for our education program, I think we did. I think there was a huge uptick. But yeah. So I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Oh, please.
If you were going to do, if you came to work, I'm not saying you don't go to work. You go to work every day. So we all go to work every day. When you open your door to your office, what is your in-office song? You know, like your walk-up song for work.
That's a fun one. Well, what's yours? You get to lead off.
Can I play mine?
Sure.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can play it.
Or you can tell me.
Oh, wow.
Crazy Horse, right?
Crazy Train. Ozzy Osbourne.
All right.
All aboard the Crazy Train.
Do you ever play this when you're going into work?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes I play it when I'm on my way home from work. What's funny is, like, it just made me start thinking, like, all of our, and everybody will hear all of our introductions of who we are, but it just made me start thinking about late 80s, early 90s, the music that I used to listen to,
mm-hmm.
I listen to now. It's like, yeah, what would that would be my walk-up song right now. Crazy Train.
Because it pumps you up and prepares you for battle, you know, now, to have the hard conversations at work?
I think a little bit. I think also the fact that a lot of higher ed sometimes just feels like you're on a crazy train going.
Right now it sure does.
But I think you have to have, like, I don't know. I think you have to have a little bit of what gets you through the day in this stuff.
Kelvin, what's yours?
I don't know if I actually have one. I have certain songs on my running playlist that I like that really motivate me to, like, you know, to get out and go for like a short run or a longer run. So yeah, I don't know if I can commit to just one. I am a big anime guy, and so there was one called Ghost in the Shell, the second series, they did a movie, but then they also did a couple seasons of like regular episodes. And there's a song called Cyberbird that I really like. That's about 6 minutes. It's, you know, it's electronica. So that's the one that if that's on, I'm always like in a good mood. And then sometimes it's the theme song to certain TV shows, like the $6 Million Man, you know, which I used to watch, or the Thundercats show. Like that little intro, talk about the 80s, right? It's like, you know, it's got everything. It's got like keyboards, guitar. It's probably one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best original theme songs for a cartoon.
I used to watch that all the time. It was an after school guilty pleasure for me, watching some Thundercats.
Yeah.
So trivia time. I know Kelvin's a big Pet Shop Boys fan. So West End Girls, man, that brings me back to with my older sister around St. Louis in the, you know, late 80s. But you know, if you want to the point that Kelvin has been to Pet Shop Boys shows in the last decade or so, they're still around and he goes to those shows if he's ever in the vicinity. So.
Yeah, I've only been to a couple, but
a couple more than most people, I would say. You know, for me, it's like, I can't just pick one. Too much good music out there. But if I'm going to get pumped up for work, when the minute you asked this question, Kevin, the first thing that popped in my head was Parliament's, We Want the Funk. Because I love that beginning, tear the roof off the mother, tear the roof off the mother sucker. Mm-hmm. So I'll drop some in today. But, if I'm going to have a pumped up song, I like something that's in a major key. So the theme for this show, our show, you'll notice is all like major keys. There's no minor keys. There's nothing. It's like I wanted it to be bright, funky, but bright. So that's why I wrote it the way I wrote it, because I wanted something that was, first of all, made it seem kind of like a talk show. Like you're coming to a talk show rather than something else. You know, we don't have a desk with coffee mugs and all that stuff. Although I suppose we could. Maybe we'll get some merch at some point, with mugs that say GSD. Higher Ed's it's an interesting place to work because it's so big. An institution can be massive. The University of Minnesota, just the Twin Cities campus, there's two campuses on Twin Cities. It is thousands and thousands of people. Even without the students, thousands of people. So there is so many places and so many relationships you need to build, you need to maintain to get stuff done. I mean, there's an old, what's his name? Jeffrey Weick, I think is his name. A scholar, he talked about higher ed is loosely coupled systems. And even little places are loosely coupled, the departments, the teams, the units, administrative and otherwise. And when you get to a big place, it is definitely loosely coupled. So it's, sometimes you need a ramp up, pump up song, like a baseball closer coming in for the ninth inning, not because you're going battle with people you don't like, but because it's just, sometimes it's a lot to keep all of those plates spinning but it's also that's what invigorates it for me. It's not like this little teeny silo sometimes. One thing I like about my job now is I'm all over the place. I get to talk to everyone in the system. Like we go on a road show every year. Our team goes to every campus. And that's what I love about it. Just moving around a campus. That's one thing I miss about pre-COVID is moving around a campus every day, walking to this place to meet people here and there. That was honestly one of my favorite parts. It is one of my favorite parts about it. You don't just go, there are people that go sit in cubicles in higher ed. Don't get me wrong, but I've not often been one and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, I think I've had the luxury of not really being one of those individuals either. I think every role that I've had has always been a role that requires engagement in multiple different places. In fact, I mean, even when I got to Nebraska, I made it a very, I had to come to this, it wasn't even like an ask. It was just any meeting that I had was always wherever that person was at. So nobody ever came to my office to have a meeting. It was always, oh, you want to talk about something? I'll meet you at the office, in your office. I'll meet you in the union. We can go have coffee across the street. We can go do whatever. But it was never like, yeah, I'm available at 10. Why don't you can swing by, you can chat it, in my office and stuff. I've always been out and about. And I think that's important because not only do you see the person you're trying to meet with, but you see all the other people who are interlayered within that person, the administrative assistant too.
You really do have to beat the pavement. Depending on the role you're in, but I mean, for you early career folks who might be listening, you have to be able to translate between worlds. You might work in one part, let's say admissions, but you need to be able to speak to or at least create a relationship with, maybe it's a program or a faculty group in that program or another unit that IT or a technology team. Being able to translate and create relationships so that translation and that collaboration really is frictionless. Beating the pavement is an important part of it. Again, working remotely, I work a few days, two, 3 days on campus, especially once the semesters are kicking or underway. But beat the pavement. You got to get out there and meet people that you're going to support across the institution and beyond that. You got to meet people because you got to understand who they are and what they're trying to do.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that as well. It's interesting though, like for me, I remember I mean, working at a community college where we just purchased access to Illuminate Live, which was like an early web conferencing tool.
Yep.
And but we didn't really use it to like contact other people, you know, to set up online meetings. We used it actually to do some early online tutoring and to do orientation sessions to online learning. Now, even though I have struggles at times with using Zoom or Teams, it really has opened up my ability just to really do these ongoing connections with folks. Like even if I was in a physical office, I do have a cubicle. I don't really have regular meetings that much with people in the office, which is always like a subset of our team because everyone's on a hybrid schedule. For the most part, there's just a couple of us who are more remote. And, but, you know, the people that I talk with are mostly like on our other University of Texas System campuses. They're across other community college and university systems. And but to all of your points, though, you have to be the person reaching out because everyone's really busy and you really have to do your best to kind of just like make sure that those connections, those partnerships are nourished on a regular basis. Don't expect it to always come back because everyone's busy.
Right.
So you have to be the initiator, the person saying, "Hey, let's jump on a call." And I feel like, you know, maybe, you know, with online learning, especially in my career, I feel like I've always had to do that because I've had to collaborate with folks. You know, higher ed can be very matrix as an organization. And so to get things done, these are like people who don't report to you, right? Like you have to form those relationships and keep them healthy.
Yeah.
I think an important part of that too is when people start to look at their professional development and what do I want to do for professional development? And what is the first thing that always comes to mind? Oh, I'm going to go to a conference. I want to go see other people from other institutions or whatever city it's in or whatever. I remember, I think it was when I was at Arkansas. My director was like, why don't you go spend a day with the College of Business? Like, let's just set up a time, go over there and just see what the College of Business does. Go spend a day in financial aid and just see how the financial aid folks operate and what they do. And I think I think there's so many opportunities in our own space to provide some sort of connections, like to your points, both of you, of meeting people, but also like there's great professional development opportunities right there on your own campus. If you would just say, "Hey, can I go shadow someone for a day just to see?" Like mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to shadow a college president for the day, you know, and just to sit in on the meetings and I'm sure they, you know, they moved things around. So it wasn't certain types of meetings that I was going to be in, but still just to see what does a college president really do? I think we all have this idea. But I think sometimes when we think about how we get stuff done and making those connections, but if we think about our professional development, it's not far away from you. Like you just need to kind of like, just, you have to own your journey a little bit too.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So now I'm forgetting where we left off as we paused for a moment here. So
we're talking about professional development, kind of doing your own professional development thing, thinking about ways. We could always change subjects too.
Well, I think that is, again, first of all, what's interesting is people will learn in our own episodes and as we talk more, all three of us, because we're old, we were around when online programs were just being thought of coming out of paper correspondence effectively, and the internet was birthing and becoming a thing. So, and making its way into higher ed, not just as, you know, mainframe computers for data analysis, but, you know, application tools, registering for courses. I mean, I still registered for courses on paper in college, and I only first time in graduate school, like 2000 is the first time I ever registered for a course online. So, a lot of the times what I found is that, I mean, first of all, there's a timing thing, but I always had to be able to jump between spaces, because here I am, I have an academic background, you know, I have a bachelor's in history, and I had a stint as a web developer before grad school. So I had these two spheres of knowledge. And then as I started grad school and different levels, I had to learn how to walk between those. And we all were in academic technology in some space along our careers. You have to be able to jump between these pools where you've got one side that, you know, they know tech. The other side, they're faculty and researchers. And you have to be able to speak a lot of the same language, but you're not necessarily a peer expert in both spaces. So I just found that, you know, the more you can jump around, or at least speak mm-hmm. those different languages, the more you can bridge those essentially cultures, the more interesting of roles you're going to find, and frankly, the better career path you're going to have.
Mm-hmm. And you may find that it's an entirely different career path than what you thought. I mean,
oh, totally.
You know, not to go into a whole lot of my scenario, but I mean, even like same thing, when I started at the University of Arkansas, they were using punch cards. They had just implemented a student information system for the first time for inputting applications. And I didn't have a technology background. I mean, yeah, my bachelor's is park resource management. My master's is history, but ended up, you know, learning how to use the system and then writing processes on how to use the system better, you know? And so like this whole project management system analysis, like just kind of just grew and was actually interesting and fun, but it took my admissions role to a totally different level. Yes. My first job was inputting applications into the system. Did I have to continue to do that? Yes, I did. But at the same time, I was also thinking through, like, how can we improve this system? How can we do things differently? And I think a lot of people just get into roles, and sometimes it's because of the way they're managed, right? They get into these roles. It's like, well, that's your job. This is what you're going to do today. And they get bored with it, or don't see a pathway to do anything else because they're not allowed to get out of that lane.
Yes. Like
that is your lane. That is, and honestly, I think that is, having worked in the corporate side of things, I think that's probably the biggest downfall of higher ed, is that we hire people for these little bubbles and we want them to only do that job because that's what we hired them for. And we don't think about all the opportunities to move out of that, versus in the corporate world, we're kind of thinking like, does this person fit in the organization? Is there a better place for them to be? Like, what skill sets have they shown? Can they demonstrate, and can we move them? But I had an interesting conversation with Oregon State a couple of weeks ago, and they actually do that exact same thing. When someone leaves their marketing department, they reevaluate all the current staff who are there. They reevaluate that job description of the person who left and they go, okay, is this what we want to rehire for? Or do you want to take some of these responsibilities, and do we want to create a whole different job description for something that we don't, that we're not, that all of us together collectively don't have the skill set? And so let's go find that person who has that skill set. That to me is like way above what I think a lot of folks in higher ed do. I think we just spend the same, someone left, I'm going to rehire in the same job. Someone left, I'm rehiring the same job. And not rethink what those roles and responsibilities are, or let the employees in those spaces kind of rethink what their role could be.
Amen to that. Testify. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you both think that sort of like our experience with the internet really, really shifted teaching, scholarship, research, and administration, just the functioning, the business enterprise of institutions when we were earlier in our careers? Is AI going to do the same thing? And is that where people who are solidly in their higher ed careers like us, or even early, become experts in that, and that will allow them to go to different destinations or find those new roles in higher ed or beyond, of course, that really flourish?
Yeah, I think there's the potential. I mean, I think it also just depends on how well institutions are, you know, prepared to help their, you know, their employees manage AI. And so it'll be interesting just to see like what lanes, right? Kevin, you brought up the lanes, like what access will you have? Like some schools might just say, hey, you have access to just one tool and you're only supposed to use it in this one way. I do feel like we're going to really need to better prepare people to be generalists across tools.
Yeah.
But I just don't know if many institutions will want there to be too much of a free range across these AI resources. But I almost feel like we're going to need to be generalists to also show our value, right? That we understand the pros and cons of different tools and hopefully show people that we're willing to continue to learn and grow, given that AI is available. So, but I think it's going to vary a lot across institutions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the product, right? I mean, AI, there's so many different components to AI. Is AI just a chatbot? Is an AI more than a chatbot? Can an AI actually take my application off of the web and actually make a decision before it even gets admitted into the SIS system to know whether or not this person, you know, meets admissions requirements? I think there's so many avenues. And I think that's where higher ed gets lost, is everybody's worried about students cheating with ChatGPT, and we're not thinking about how can we actually improve our systems and things that we do. But I also think a lot of times higher ed relies on those entities to tell us how to use AI, right? Like Canvas is going to come to us and tell us how we should be implementing AI within Canvas, right? It's going to be the products telling us how it's used and what to do with it versus us being a little bit more innovative. But I also think Georgia Tech is doing some really interesting things with
AI. On which side, the teaching and learning side or the
administrative? The teaching and learning side, yeah. I mean, they basically have like a, I think I shared this with you, and it's kind of creepy when you think about what they're doing, but just the way that they're testing it and what they're able to do. But you can be in an online course, and one of your first postings could be tell us about yourself, share who you are with the class, you know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And AI will actually comb those and go, hey, Fritz, we noticed that Kelvin also likes to run, and you said that you like to run. You two might want to connect, or the two of you actually live in New York. You might want, you know, to get together personally rather than just in the online course. So there's a little bit of kind of like weirdness to it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you're in a class, and again, Georgia Tech, a lot of their classes are run very similar to MOOCs. And so you could be in a class of 1,000 people. And so to comb through 1,000, like to read everybody else's response, you're going to miss people. And so I can see where it's making, like, it's helpful there from a little bit to just say, hey, here's 7 people who had similar interest as you in class that you might want to, but you can also kind of see where it's just like, is it the dating game? And like, someone's just matching me up with somebody else. If I'm an introvert or an extrovert, like, how do I take that? But it is cool.
So the University of Minnesota we're only two, three weeks into implementing Gemini as our enterprise AI platform. So it is early, early days. There is no, and we're also, you know, we have a new-ish president. We have a brand new provost. So we're in the middle of a strategic planning process this summer and fall. So there is no directive yet as to how we're supposed to use this tool, how we could learn to use it well, there's no expectations out there of what this could be yet. I imagine there will be, but I'm starting to talk to people about how to use it in our business processes, you know, in our work. I want to use it as a giant, you know, a giant lever for me and our team to amplify what we do. Can I do it? Can I do market research for programs just as fast, or can I create performas faster? Because those are like really niche-y, big, nasty spreadsheets. So I want to use it as a way to speed up what I do, but still maintain the quality. I just, you know, as a volume amplifier. But you know, I get what you're saying though, is that the product vendors are going to really, they're going to make their moves in it based on what they see and what they think will let them differentiate themselves in the market, et cetera. Coursera, for example, they're really rolling out a bunch of AI tools right now. Mm-hmm. So I manage Coursera for the University of Minnesota, which means I help develop content for it. I find opportunities to do that. And so I'm talking to them all the time, and there are all kinds of things to make it seem, to make it feel more like a smaller scale learning environment. So putting AI tools into the discussion forums so that people can have conversations, learners can have conversations, or at least get peer reviews faster from their, for their assignments and assessments they're doing. So, you know, again, they're making these moves based on what they see is what they can do, what the needs are, what they see as opportunity to do that. So I think you're spot on, is that hiring's not going to be largely told, but at some point I think they need to start figuring out every institution needs to figure out a path through it. What's the best way to utilize this? I mean, and how many institutions are not going to be able to do that? Because if in a very resource constrained environment like we're in now, mm-hmm. it's going to be yet another thing that's going to separate have from have not institutions, ones that are struggling because of enrollment drops and other kinds of challenges, but they just not going to be able to play in that space, to be able to operate in that space. And that again, just drags them further down. Something I really haven't thought about till just this moment.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true.
So go ahead, man.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say these are the kind of conversations I think people can expect. This one's been, I think,
appropriate. This one's been all over the place.
But we've meandered.
It's been good.
In the higher ed world. But, you know, I think it gives people a sense that who we are, the kinds of experiences we've had, the perspectives we bring, you know, so we've been talking about tech, we've talked about demographics, we've talked about history of higher ed, like we've covered ground, but I still think it's been coherent. Please, you know, let us know if we're not coherent. But I do think it's grounded in certainly in our experiences, but it's grounded in this higher ed space, and that what ultimately, how does higher ed functioning internally from a macro and a micro perspective? So these are the kind of conversations I love, and I'm looking forward to more of them.
Yeah, same here.
I would agree. I mean, I think for the people who are listening and people who want to continue to listen, I think they'll have some ahas that they'll walk away with. And I think they'll have some, those three dudes don't know what the hell they're talking about, which I think is fine too. Or they might gravitate towards one or the other and just be like, I'm team Fritz all the way. He's always got the right answers. well, no, I think this is a good intro showcase to our thoughts and ideas of how this is going to kind of come together. And, I look forward to having a few guests, and I also look forward to having more conversations where we just kind of just pontificate of the world of higher ed.
Yes, indeed. Kelvin, what are you thinking as we kind of wrap things up here?
No, just looking forward to us kind of again covering an interesting array of topics. Looking forward to also seeing who will potentially be guests to kind of add into the conversation. And who knows, after doing a few episodes, we might have, you know, there might be some other folks that may want to just join us, you know, on the podcast too. So you never know how the podcast will evolve over time. But I'm looking forward to that evolution. And as we start a new school year, as our kids are going back to school and we're kind of going back to school, even though we're on 12-month contracts. It'll be interesting to see what's coming up next for higher ed, especially in terms of you know, what's coming out of the federal government, Department of Ed, Department of Labor and Commerce. All kinds of crazy things are coming. So it'll be interesting just to see how higher ed reacts to all of that. Thank you.